I'm Greg Johnson. Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. Tonight, I have three special guests, and they are going to school me in a topic about which I am woefully ignorant, which is British popular culture in the 1990s. So first, I want to welcome on Trav LeBlanc, who suggested the topic. Trav, welcome.
Yes. Hello.
Great. And you suggested that I ask Morgoth and Millennial Woes. So, Woes, first of all, welcome to the show.
Hello. I'm just sharing the link there. Yeah, okay. Thanks for inviting me onto this. I think it's a very interesting topic because I think about it pretty much, well, yeah, every day, maybe okay. Every hour. I think about the world that I grew up in and emerged into adulthood in, and I think nostalgically about it, but also, yeah, there's a mix of feelings. I mean, we can go into all of that.
Well, great. And the other guest tonight is Morgoth. Morgoth, welcome.
Well, thanks for having me back again. I've got a little bit of a cold, so I may sound a bit snivelly in my voice. I may cough a little bit if I talk out there for a long time, just so people know.
Well, you come from damp climates, right? People expect that of you. So you're from somewhere in the far north, right?
The funny thing is, it's been lovely weather for the past few days, but now I've been hit with. I don't get things like this in the winter, but I get them when the warm weather starts to come in. But it is what it is.
Well, great. So we will talk about the topic at hand for the first hour. And then I figured we could open this up for super chats. And of course, people can continue with the topic at hand, or they can bring up other things that are in the news or that just interest them. And we'll all give our best takes on it. If you'd like to do a super chat through Entropy, look across the bottom of your screen. It says entropystream.live/countercurrents, no hyphen. Just go there, hit the green button. And you can take out your credit card and leave a super chat. We're very much appreciative of that. Also, you can send tips through Odyssey, and you can send DLive tokens, which we will collect together and at the end of the year cash in and apply towards our fundraiser goals. And they do add up. So thank you very much. Eventually, we're going to be streaming on Rumble, but I've been having some technical issues with that. So I haven't actually done that yet. Next week, we'll probably start streaming on Rumble as well. So let's begin with Trav. Trav, what interests you in this topic? What have I been missing?
Well, now this is something like the 90s kind of Britpop phenomenon in the greater Cool Britannia zeitgeist or something. I've kind of been interested. People talk about how, you know, hopelessly woke and cucked Britain is, but like 30 years ago, it was in the midst of this kind of quasi-nationalist zeitgeist, like a renewed cultural self-confidence. Now, in America, we mostly associate the 90s with grunge culture, but in the UK, it was all about this kind of Britpop phenomenon, which in large part was a reaction to grunge. And I got to experience both, because grunge was kind of like the soundtrack of my high school years. And then I've been to the UK twice, once in 1996, when Britpop was like at its peak. And then I went again in 1998, as it was dying. And it was a much like larger, it was a much bigger deal in the UK than grunge ever was in America. So I thought it was like a worthwhile thing to kind of take a look at, is how the UK went from this very, you know, like I said, it's quasi-nationalistic kind of cultural zeitgeist to where now it's very almost Americanized, kind of woke, you know. And in hindsight, there's been a lot of revisionism about the kind of Britpop of Cool Britannia era. Some people think it's, you know, it's too... I think some in like the woke media have been trying to kind of retcon it into a right-wing thing. So I thought it'd be a good discuss with some actual Britons who were actually there when it was going on. Now, very few Britpop bands actually made it over to or broke big in America. Oasis was the only one that did. Blur were like 1.5 hit wonders. Girls and Boys was like a minor hit, and then Song 2 was a major hit, but the rest never really got through. Now, there was a college radio station near my house. On Sunday nights, they had this syndicated show called Rock Over London, which kind of played music that was going on in the UK scene. So I had to follow it through this one like radio show that came on Sunday nights. And I remember, you know, kind of being a teenager delivering pizzas, listening to like, you know, Lush and like Suede and all that stuff. It was a much more exciting, I think a much more exciting movement than grunge was in America. It was also far more pervasive, whereas grunge was like a youth culture thing, whereas the Britpop thing had much more like across the board appeal. It broke through merely just like the cool kids, the hipsters and stuff. And it, you know, where even like, you know, middle-aged people knew who the kind of hot bands were at the time. So I wanted to get the impressions of like Woz and Morgoth as to what they remember about the Cool Britannia kind of cultural zeitgeist that was going on in the 90s.
Do you want to go first, Woz, or shall I?
Well, okay, let me just briefly say this. There was a lot of culture going on in Britain in the 90s. Britpop is a specific thing. That has to be defined, I think, right at the beginning. For example, Erasure, the band, they brought out an album in 94 and they brought out another one in 95. Those albums do not count as Britpop because it's Erasure and they're an electronic, fairly gay 80s group. So that it's very important to note that. Britpop bands would be Pulp, that was my favourite, Blur, which was the standard middle class favourite, and Oasis, which was the standard working class favourite. That's a thing in itself, that Britpop, there was a middle class, it was cross class. That's a very important thing to note, because that's kind of unusual in Britain. It was also associated with Brit art, which was the absolutely appalling stuff by Tracy Emin, Damien Hirst. I've forgotten all the other names now because it was all so awful. Then it became associated with New Labour via the term Cool Britannia. And pretty much as soon as that happened, as soon as Labour won the election, I think that was May 97, Britpop sort of died. And Oasis brought out an album called, I think it was Be Here Now, which was nobody was excited by it. No one liked, as I recall. It was very much an anti-climax. And that was it. And by 98, it was really over. And there was a brief post-Britpop thing, like bands like The Verve, which was just a small thing before the millennium, which was its own story. So Britpop was, yes, a sort of nationalism, but it was definitely, it was civic nationalist. Nobody would ever have, none, like these were liberals, very much liberal people, and none of them would ever have been wanted to be associated with racism, as they would say, as they would call it. It was a civic nationalist pride. And yet, because we were still in 1994, it was vastly a white thing. So when you look back on it now, it's just, you know, whatever your feelings about the music itself, it does look pretty bloody good. I guess you could say it seeped into other, like, TV, film. It did, in the sense of, you know, Trainspotting, Shallow Grave, but those are really, and then there was that, like, Rancid Aluminium, and I've forgotten when Dazed and Confused came out. But there was definitely, and there was one Shopping with Sadie Frost and Jude Law. But those are minor things. The Britpop film is Trainspotting, which came out in 96. So I think I would leave it at that. TV, not so much, I don't think. That's all I'll say for now.
I mean, the TV program, there was a couple of things on the TV side of it, because I would say it was a general vibe, but it's the bands that came out that get all the attention, because I do think they were the driving force. And to go to the roots of that, from the more Oasis side of it, you would have to go back a little bit earlier, probably even to the Smiths, And then into bands like the Stone Roses in the late 80s and into the early 90s. And then Oasis kind of picked up that they used to call it Manchester vibe. There was a kind of Northern Soul was another thing they'd call it, where you had this like very good music, but they were working class, mainly from around the Manchester region. That wasn't a new thing, really. It went all the way back to New Order, even, and Joy Division. And I think there was a kind of a lineage there that sort of culminated with Oasis, who became the biggest and the most sort of rocky. And obviously they drew heavily on the Beatles. And that was one side of it. But then you also had bands which were kind of there half in and they're adding into the general mix of it all, like the Prodigy. And I went to see the Orb, who are a bit more psychedelic and a bit more out there, and the Prodigy, and I went to see Pulp as well. So Pulp was the Lakers' worst scene. That was my favorite Britpop band. But what I think interesting is that you also had at this time a lot of the Merchant and Ivory dramas with people like Anthony Hopkins and Emma Thompson, which was a lot more classy and a lot more highbrow. And it would be these sort of costume drama set in Edwardian England, like Remains of the Day, where it was very genteel and it was very sort of celebrating the English sort of class system and archetypes. Remains of the Day in particular, they're great films. And I think that all added in, there was just, for one reason or another, which we can get into, there was just a lot of good stuff, a lot of quality, like, on all fronts, it seemed, across the entire cultural sphere. But at the time, I wasn't really conscious that there was a kind of vibe going on. I was just in it. One of the things that I remember is in 96, which was kind of at the peak of it all, you also had the Euro, the European Cup was hosted in Britain as well. So you had all of these, which meant that all of the football stadiums up and down the country had to muck in and host. So where I was, Newcastle, St. James's Park, and then you also had like actual English great football players like Alan Shearer. But then all of a sudden you would have like Germany would come to Newcastle or where all these big names and big teams, and it was just so much energy and so much was going on. But in terms of the television, I was mentioning this before to somebody, there was a couple of programs that I thought were kind of ominous, and one of them was called This Life and the other one was called Queer as Folk, which I didn't watch at all. But This Life was about these upcoming lawyers in London. They were all in their early 20s, and it was kind of multiracial and very, very liberal. And it was the sign that these high-status go-getters were just completely different to me, and their values are different and everything. And I thought what was ominous is that these are the people who are heading into positions of power. These are the people who are going to be manning the institutions in 10 or 20 years, which is, it turned out the case. And I can imagine, for example, the Conservative Party today, like all of the people in the top positions of the Conservative Party would have probably like been in their early 20s watching This Life when it was on at the time. And so you get this kind of arc that carries across it. I mean, as for the nationalist sort of patriotic element, it was kind of ironic in a way. And what you saw resurrected quite a bit were earlier tropes, like the Italian Job movie. There was a lot of, it was a kind of taking the swinging 60s atmosphere and kind of doing a 90s postmodern spin on it. So you get the kind of gratuitous use of the Union Jack. Now, in the Italian Job, where they've got the minis are also a sort of signifier of British patriotism, which is safe, and pride, which is fine. It is a symbol of identity. And then in the 90s, you'd get, say, Jerry Halliwell wearing the Union Jack, famously. I think it was at the Brit Awards, which was another thing that was going on as well. But it was sort of ironic and safe, I would say. I mean, one of the big bands at the time was called Ocean Colour Scene. And the drummer, I think it was actually a black man. So you had a kind of a rock band, but with a black drummer. And it was just sort of, yeah, okay, because we were all still race blind. We hadn't, and there was no demographic threat. So it was just all kind of cool in the gang. I mean, in a way, it was a very kind of naive and innocent time as well. But I'll leave that there.
That makes me think of another band called Dread Zone. There was also Kula Shaker. There was another sort of multicultural thing.
Yes, they did a song in what, like Hindi or something like that?
Something like that, yeah.
Into Jaya Jaya, whatever.
Yeah, exactly. But Dread Zone, I only knew at the time, I only knew one song by them, and it was actually called Little Britain. And it was a celebration of multicultural or multiracial Britain. And multicultural, because there was a lyric in it, no matter what your color, your race or your culture, this land of ours, etc. It was, and so it's this very much civic nationalist, but even pro-multicultural message, because it was all very naive. And that was a multiracial band, Dread Zone. But it's very... there was a huge sense of optimism. So something I should have said earlier was that, yes, it was sort of ironic. It was sort of knowing, but it was also sincere in the sense that it was genuine excitement and optimism about Britain's future. And it was riffing on the 60s for sure. It was also riffing on the 70s, but not really the 80s. That was another thing I should have said, is that it was a sort of reaction to rave and house music. A lot of those bands that had, like Oasis, for example, I remember seeing Noel Gallagher moaning about how awful rave music was, and he said you had to take drugs in order to listen to it, in order to dance to it. And he hated it, he didn't like it. And they didn't want, like Oasis, they didn't use synthesizers, certainly not in any sort of prominent way. So it was rejecting the 80s. And I remember certain bands explicitly saying that they hated the 80s. They hate 80s music. So that's another part of it. I'll just say that for now. But the one thing about rave and house and just electronic synthetic music is that it was seen at the time as sort of hippie, gay, and actually a bit globalist, like non-British, which is weird because Britain was actually at the forefront of electronic music, but it was seen in the 90s by a certain strand, at least, as non-British. So the British music was the 60s. It was the Kinks, the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, maybe, that sort of thing. I think that was what they were harking back to.
Well, in a way, it was a reaction to the 80s. Now, indie music is like a continuation of punk. And I think in the 90s is what you saw, kind of like the final abandonment of certain like punk ethics that were still going strong in the 80s. Whereas indie music in the 80s was, it was kind of defined by nonconformity, anti-corporate, anti-commercialism. And the worst thing you could do was sell out, you know. It was, indie music in the 80s was about is not treating music like a commodity. Now, in the 90s, that kind of fell away, where it is about getting music beyond like the readers of the music weeklies, NME, Melody Maker, Sounds, and all that.
Yeah, it was populist. So, yeah.
Yes. Yeah, it was a populist. It was music for the masses rather than, you know, just the bedroom romantics, which was what it was. And it was also a lot more macho, because I remember through the 80s, I sort of associated with 80s indie music with like very effeminate singers with like, you know, poofy hair.
The Cure.
Jangly guitars and stuff. And also very artsy fartsy. So what's one thing that sort of separated Britpop from the past? There's a couple things. First, it's kind of the embracing commercialism, I guess, and, you know, mass appeal. Now, you also say it was very white, and it wasn't just so much because it was a wider country. It was also kind of a, the nativism of Britpop seemed to be more kind of like anti-American rather than anti-immigrants or something like that. Whereas, you know, like Morgoth mentioned Manchester, that still had a lot of American influence. A lot of the techno stuff coming out of America was part of that. Where Britpop was, it wasn't just, you know, that was extremely white. It was also kind of a rejection of any American influences. You know, it wasn't dancey. Rejection of like drum machines and stuff like that. Relying on, you know, very, like I said, British influences, that was sort of the zeitgeist. And it was also the primary architects of Britpop, which would be like Blur and I think Suede. Suede were always my favorite band because they were the most artsy fartsy, and they were kind of like this an updated Smiths. Where did I go with this?
There were so many bands. I mean, there are lots of one-hit wonders as well.
Oh yes,
but undoubtedly the three big ones. I mean, Suede are there as well. They were big, mm-hmm. but the three biggest ones were Oasis, Blur, and Pulp. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of like Conservative, Labour, and Lib Dem. It's this triumvirate at the top, mm-hmm. and. That was how I saw it. But, you know, it really depends whether you want to talk about just British popular culture in the 90s or specifically Britpop, because I think Britpop did dominate everything, but it was quite a specific thing. And, I mean, you could get conspiratorial about it and wonder whether it was all engineered so as to bring in new labour. I don't know, and I don't think so, but I have heard people suggest that.
Yeah, Kevin Shields of the band My Bloody Valentine said that he thought it was a government conspiracy.
I remember when Noel Gallagher was at 10 Downing Street. I think it must have been just after the election, just after they got in and all that. And they did this meeting that like a wine meeting or something with all these famous people, like Ben Elton, I think, was there. And it was seen very much as selling out to the establishment because, well, the Labour Party were now the establishment. Even if they were now, you know, cool, they were still the establishment. So for these rock bands and subversive writers to hobnob with them was seen as selling out. And, you know, because as we now know, New Labour were an absolutely dreadful thing for Britain. I mean, Morgoth, is there any way in which that's not true, but that New Labour was a good thing for Britain? I don't think so.
No, not at all. But the wider context of all of that is that the Conservatives have been in for, I mean, most people's lives. If you were, let's say, beginning from 1979, and then if you go up to, say, 1995, that's 16 years. If you're just a youngster, you probably knew nothing except Conservative government. It was just this exhaustion with it. Remember they had John Major and on Spitting Image?
Like, he was grey.
Yeah, he was grey. He was in black and white, and he would just sit like with a little bit of Spam and some peas and a sprout on his, and it was just so boring and dull. I mean, I wouldn't mind a bit of that now, Lee. But you know, the immigration was 40,000 a year or something at that point. And there was no indication. I was actually looking at Labour's election pledge of 1997, and it was all very boring stuff about schools, about something to do with getting young people back into work, and then there was the minimum wage. And it was the minimum wage, which, I mean, I didn't vote, but that was kind of the big draw. And so there was a bit of enthusiasm. There was a bit of like, you call me Tony is what he used to say, Tony Blair. I think he even popped up on like a morning talk show with a guitar or something at one point. And he had his little things about wearing the suit, but not a tie. And it all ended up where like the Gallagher brothers were snorting cocaine off a toilet in number 10 Downing Street. He was all down with it, you know. But
there was also his, he did a GQ magazine, they had photos off him that were very slick, and no politician had done that in Britain before, as far as I know. That was definitely part of casting him as a young, cool, modern, informal leader, just completely different from the Tories. I mean, it's interesting what you say about the policies there, because it's possible that it wasn't actually any of their policies. It was just all hype and optics.
And I mean, funny thing is, but just to touch on the magazines, you had magazines going around like Loaded. And part of it was there was like really a big thing like with lads culture and lads going out drinking together and being what, like, it was almost like misogyny was kind of being encouraged low-key, you know, if you want to call it that. But then again, the women around at the time were not really much better. It was a loose time. I remember Zoe Ball, who would have been about 27 or something at the time, she came on like a Chris Evans show or something like that, and just pulled a top up and flashed up boobs live to the audience, or live on air. There was nothing you could do about it in those days. If it went out, it went out, and that was it. And it was. I was going out on the drinking in the big market. It was absolutely degenerate. It was absolutely a loose time. But it may have been like sort of the death throes of a civilization, but it was a great time. It was a fun time to be young. It's crazy because 4 years ago we were in the year 2020, and if it was let's say in 1996-97, you were like 4 years away from 9/11, or the turn of the millennium was another thing which was looming. The internet was just kind of coming, you know, just beginning to be a thing, and all of this kind of thing. And it was as if it was a sort of a last big party before like the end of everything, is something like that.
Yes,
this kind of last gasp of freedom and identity and knowing who we were before the hammer was going to fall.
Yeah, although that's how it looks in retrospect. But there was also the fact that New Labour were looking to the future, and they were interested in the millennium. I think as soon as they got in, there was the Millennium Dome project. And there was also the other things like the Millennium Bridge. And I think the thing that you alluded to earlier about getting young people into work, there was a thing called the University of Industry or something like that, which I'd completely missed at the time. But I happened to discover it last year when doing research for something else. And it was a big New Labour project to sort of transform education in Britain. And no one talks about it now. But it was a huge thing from about 1990. They were planning this, and then they brought it into being around 2000. So they were looking to the future. Well, and everyone else was feeling optimistic, but everyone else was looking really. It was kind of nostalgic.
I mean, the a band that we haven't mentioned, which were huge, were the Manic Street Preachers.
Yes,
and. When you they were actually around earlier in the 90s. They had a what was it, the motorcycle song? What was
motorcycle emptiness?
Yes, And one of the band members disappeared, never to be seen again. So they had this kind of weird aura about them. There was a kind of dark thing about the Manic Street Preachers. And everybody was like, I wonder whatever happened to the guitarist or the drummer, or somebody disappeared, like just disappeared. Nobody ever knew what happened.
Richie Edwards was his name.
Yeah, did he ever turn up? Did he ever?
No, there have been sightings of him. Supposedly someone saw him like in a village in India. It's kind of like Elvis Presley in the 80s, where there's all sorts of sightings. I once met a guy who claims that he saw him somewhere. A guy who, he said he used to like sell t-shirts at festivals in the UK, claimed he saw Richie Edwards on the subway somewhere. So yeah, no one ever knows what happened to that guy. They were supposed to go on like a tour of the United States. And the day before he like checked out of his hotel room, he had withdrawn like 200 pounds a day from an ATM for the two previous weeks. At his house, they found his passport lying around on his bed. And they found his car abandoned next to a bridge that was known for suicides, but they've never found his body. So it's been just a mystery as to whatever happened to that guy. Oh, and another thing is that he didn't actually play on any of the albums. He was just in the band to do interviews and write lyrics.
All right. But they in, I remember they came out with the album Everything Must Go, which was massive. I mean, I think that probably sold more than the Oasis. That was huge. And I would put them well into the Britpop scene as well. But when you actually, so, you know, you've got this thing where you've got all these kids who aren't really political at all. But the Manic Street Preachers were like raging shitlibs. Like they were really far left.
They were kind of.
And when you look at the words and like the sort of the rage that he sang the songs, the famous one, what is it? I've got the words up here to Everything Must Go.
Design for Life was their big song.
Yeah, Design for Life as well. Shed some skin for the fear within is starting to hurt me with everything. Freed from the memory, escape from our history, and then he screamed that bit. And I just hope that you can forgive us, but everything must go. If you need an explanation, then everything must go. I look to the future, it makes me cry, but it seems too real to tell you why. Freed from the century, with nothing but memory. And it's kind of like this kind of revolutionary Bolshevik song, but the likes of us would all be like singing and clapping along to it in the pub, just completely oblivious to what it is that you are saying. And I think that says a lot. I think there's a lot about the Britpop stuff where if you peel back the surface a little bit, there was a lot of kind of radical leftist stuff around, which I at least just wasn't conscious of at all in it. It wasn't until years later when I was saying, yeah, Design for Life, what a cracking tune. And somebody said, like, they're communists, mate. Like, they're literal communists. Just look at the words. He's even got a one about, if I can shoot rabbits, then why can't I... if I can shoot a rabbit, why can't I shoot a fascist? And all of this kind of
thing. Yeah, that was, if you tolerate this, your children will be next, which is a song about the Spanish Civil War. That was kind of the joke, is that they were just preposterously intellectual for a pop group.
Yeah, and they had that certain aura at the time that some of their lyrics just didn't make sense. It seemed like esoteric, and I didn't know I didn't know about Richie Edwards disappearing. That's actually the first I've ever heard of this. I didn't know that they were communists, but it doesn't surprise me because I never understood their lyrics at the time. It was just sort of baffling.
Yeah, they were a four-piece during their kind of early kind of underground days. By the time they like broke mainstream, they were a three-piece. He kind of vanished, but he was a big part of the mystique.
Greg, I don't know where you want to take this now.
I'm just enjoying listening. I'm trying to count the bands that I've actually heard of, and I haven't heard of any except bands that you've mentioned, like Nirvana or the Smiths, who weren't part of this Britpop phenomenon. During the 1990s, I was very much buried in university studies. I was very much into classical music and jazz too, exploring a lot of that. And I just totally lost track of popular music during the 90s with a couple of tiny exceptions. I was just pondering this while we were talking. I think I might have bought maybe half a dozen, well, maybe 10 pop albums during the entire decade of the 1990s. And I was just trying to remember what they were. The only new band that I ever heard of in the 90s that I started liking and following was Rammstein. And I realized that was 1997. I first heard them in the soundtrack of David Lynch's Lost Highway. And I also heard Trent Reznor then and took a little listen to that and didn't like it. I heard the Smashing Pumpkins and, you know, that didn't go anywhere. But the only other people that I bought during the 1990s were people that I had gotten to know in the 80s or even before. I remember getting several releases by David Bowie, Outside and Earthling and The Hours, which are all excellent. I remember really liking Pop by U2 and Octoon Baby. And there was one Madonna album, which is probably her greatest achievement, which was Ray of Light. And I think that's it for the 1990s. So I just had my head in the clouds during that entire decade. And all these bands that you're mentioning are completely new to me. During the 90s, I never heard of Kurt Cobain or Nirvana until after he was dead. I think I actually started listening to that music around 2000. And then I sort of caught up with some of the stuff that I had missed. But none of the Britpop stuff, mostly just grunge stuff is what I missed.
That's part of what Britpop was, is it was making music for a specifically British audience, which mm-hmm. I think is what made it very popular in Britain, but made it very unpalatable, you know, in the United States. I mean, very few of it broke through.
Yeah, and it wouldn't. And see, that's another thing that Morgoth will probably talk about this as well, that there was a particular site, if you were to sum up Britpop with one song, that was most representative of the whole thing, I would say it was Blur's Park Life. Now, the imagery in that video, first of all, looking at it now, it's astonishingly white, but it's all these different sort of motifs from British life, and not even recent. I mean, some of it is recent. Some of it goes back to the 50s. And probably beyond that, like a teapot, just quaint things like that. They're being used semi-ironically, but also affectionately. So it's very much a celebration of British life, and it was. I think I wouldn't expect it really to be popular anywhere else, because frankly, the music itself wasn't that great, but it was. But it was culturally resonant with British people, and it was made so with the imagery that it was associated with it. So yeah, there are a lot of different.
I would say the Pulp's "Common People" would be probably the anthem. There was, yeah. I mean, you had like one hit wonder ones like it was a dance one, but it was in Trainspotting, the Born Slippy, that big dance album with the kind of. But in terms of translating it to Americans, like I really think the Americans would have struggled at the time to get like Jarvis Cocker's lyrics, because again it was very ironic. Jarvis Cocker was very he was very much a kind of intellectual, and he was very postmodern. And he would, the lyrics of Pulp, like I just looked, one of the albums they had was called We're All Sorted for Ease and Whiz. And his lyrics would be like how he skillfully, he'd be cycling down to meet a girl who would always like brush him off. And on his way down, he would like cycle and like try to dodge a dog turd on the floor, but it would squirt up his back of his suit. And he had a song where, if you listen to all of the lyrics, they're really good tunes, but some of it's creepy. He's got one song where he hides in the wardrobe. He follows a girl home from school who he fancies. All of the songs are like that, how he's a loser. And he hid inside of a wardrobe That's the chorus. I hid inside her wardrobe. And then he was spying on her, like undressing from inside the wardrobe. But then the other sister came home and he ended up like having sex with her, and they had a, she got pregnant by accident. And he ended up having a, and it was all this kind of, and especially common people, it was all this sort of nudge and a bit of a nod and a bit of a wink to celebrating these very British, like the mundane aspects of British, like going to Tesco's on a Sunday morning in like a Vauxhall Maestro or whatever, the Austin Maestro and all of these kinds of things. And so everybody could relate to it. Everybody could like directly relate to the words. And I did like Pulp, and I went to see them. That was a great concert. But I think the band that I liked, I mean, I should say before I get into that, one of the big things that happened, like the big scandals of the media age, was at the Brit Awards ceremonies. Because I think Travis is right. I think there was a kind of sort of snobbery towards America. If you just look at what was coming out of America at the time, like Nirvana would be in there very big, and Trent Reznor, you would have Pearl Jam and all of these things. It was all very, very serious and kind of navel-gazy and introspective and a bit woe is me. Whereas in Britain, the Britpop scene was all positive, and it was all related with going out and having sex and sniffing drugs and just having a great time and living it up. And when you look over at the American scene at that time, just seemed so dour and depressing. But I think one of the things that happened, which kind of puts this into perspective, is when Michael Jackson arrived. Now, obviously, he's much more the king of pop. That he's much more mainstream. But he came on the stage at the Brits, as they called it, this big awards ceremony, and he was kind of presenting himself as Jesus, and he had like children singing in a choir, and he it was so pretentious. And Jarvis Cocker from Pulp ran down and stormed the stage, and then he kind of wiggled his arse at the fans, and he was wrestled to the floor, and it was this massive scandal. And when he said, like, why did you do it? And he said, because I think it's sick. I'm not sure if that was related to the sort of the paedophile allegations. I'm not sure if it was to do with it. But at any rate, he was like, he needs to be brought down a peg or two. He literally thinks he's Jesus. He's just singing pop songs, for God's sake. And I think that kind of exemplifies what was going on there. But for me, just to go back on the kind of misery stuff, I liked Radiohead more than any of the normal Britpop bands at the time. And they're classed on Google as a Britpop band, but they didn't seem like that at all because they were too serious. They seemed more American.
Yeah, I'd have to look at when those albums came out, OK Computer and the next one, but I associate them as sort of post Britpop, like the Verve.
But well, I remember
arbitrary.
I had a really shitty job where I worked with a friend of mine, and we both worked there. It was horrible. And we finished work one day, and it was 1997, and he had Radio One on. So Radio One at the time, you have to remember, it wasn't just all black music. That was like sort of where all the Britpop stuff was going on. So you just put Radio One on in the car. And I remember, I didn't know what it was. I recognized it was Radiohead, but we didn't, in the pre-internet age, a lot of the time you didn't even know that somebody had a new record out until you heard it on the radio. And we heard, it was Paranoid Android that came on, and it was like 6 minutes long. And it was this kind of weird psychedelic rock opera that had lots of different parts, and it was really dark and kind of but great at the same time. And it came on, and we knew it was Radiohead because we recognized Tom York's voice, but we were like, what the hell is this? Like, this is next level. And we were thinking at the time, so this would have been summer 97, I think, And we were thinking, I mean, this is amazing. This is so next level. Like, this is so original. Like, imagine how great the music's going to be in 5 years from now. Imagine how amazing everything's going to be 10 years from now. And in my opinion, I mean, I've got a take that I think Radiohead ended pop music. I think it was like there's only so much you can get out of a particular form before there's nothing left. There's not really any new compositions. There's not really anywhere you can take it. And I have a take that I think Radiohead kind of just blew it up, just sort of finished it. And there's been a few things here and there since, but in terms of mainstream stuff, I think that's when it peaked. And it was great. And that was also 97. You got Blur came in at about that time, and so it was literally the peak of Britpop as well.
Yeah, definitely. And the Verve, I keep mentioning the Verve because that's also, I mean, it was part of Britpop, but it was dark and gloomy like Radiohead. And so it doesn't fit into that sort of euphoric 94 to 96, 97 thing. It really was as soon as New Labour came into power, I think, that it ended. But it also occurred to me that the whole thing was bookended by two Richard Curtis films. So at the start, you've got Four Weddings and a Funeral, which I think was 94. And then at the end, you've got Notting Hill, which was also very big and popular. And then so even more was Love Actually in, I think, 2003. But Four Weddings really kick-started that. There was that moment where, in British cinema where there were these popular films. Another one would be Brassed Off. Another one would obviously be Trainspotting and Shallow Grave. I mentioned Dazed and Confused earlier. I was mistaken there. That was an American film. But there was a similar... Yes, that was it. Human Traffic. Yes, thank you. That's the one I was going for. So there was a moment where you had these British films that were obviously very low budget compared to America, but very good. It was that thing where Britain would do something, an equivalent of an American thing, but on a much lower budget. But it was still very good, very competent, very lots of talent. So that was British cinema at that time.
You also Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels, which was like the British Quentin Tarantino kind of.
Yes, definitely, definitely. I think that was 97. So it you can or 98. So yeah, you can see that there was this very much a compressed sort of concrescence of activity, not mostly in music but in other genres as well. TV, Morgoth mentioned Queer as Folk. That was 99. I definitely wouldn't associate that with Britpop, but it was a result of that sort of optimism and energy and slickness that was there in Britpop, but definitely not part of Britpop. Apart from anything else, Britpop was not really gay at all. You could say Jarvis Cocker was, yes, he was a prancing art school sort of type. And it wasn't, I mean, I don't know, I guess there would be a certain cachet in not being homophobic, in being okay with having a gay friend. But it wasn't gay. It definitely, there was definitely very much still a macho, and the Lads Mags thing was a whole huge part of that as well. Loaded, Maxim, FHM, Sky, these magazines. So it was very much a laddish sort of thing. The Queer as Folk, that was, I definitely see that as a separate era. Very much the millennial era.
Now, one thing I wanted to bring up is a feature of Britpop was that it was very class conscious, because you said the definitive Britpop song was Park Life, and then Morgoth said it was Common People, and both of those are very, very class conscious songs.
Yes.
And it's one of the features of that era. It's the Mockney trend. It became like fashionable for middle class people to kind of affect a working class accent. I wanted to ask Morgoth what your impressions of that, of the Mockney phenomenon was, as a genuine working class person.
Well, I'm not sure what it is.
Is when affecting a working class accent, middle class people affecting working class, is called Mockney.
Yeah, but what would be an example of that?
David Tennant in Doctor Who, where he's got that sort of cheeky chappy accent. God, it's difficult to think. But also, Tony Blair went to a very good private school, and yet he would drop his T's. That was a big thing. That really started
David
with him.
Was accused of Mockney. He was not actually as working class as he tried to come off.
Yeah, definitely. It was a thing where you would just make your Well,
I was trying to think of people sort of changing their accents to sound more working class, but I couldn't really think of anything like that. But I think I was, and what it pushed towards was this kind of informality, where you didn't want to be coded, as they say now, as being a Tory, as belonging to the old establishment. You wanted to belong to the new up and coming big energy craze, where all the positivity was. So I think though there's quite a bit of that went on with it. But I can't imagine people like just dropping their accents and things. I mean, if anything, something like Pulp was having a laugh at the class thing. Well, you could say kind of with Common People. I mean, the gist of Common People is that, actually. The story, as I say, the story of Common People is a posh girl from Greece, or I think she had a family in Greece, and she's got like a gap year, and she ends up... She's coming to stay in like Sheffield or wherever Jarvis Cocker was from, and she's going to kind of slum it with the English working class for a few months. And what he's singing about is that what Cocker's saying is that you'll never be one of us, you'll never be one of them. And all in the lyrics, it's like you don't know what it's like to watch the mold climbing up the wall. And what's the line where, and if it gets too much, you can just call your dad and he'll take you home, and all of these kinds of words in it. And it's like really an anthem for the working class, which is to say, like, you can't be us whether you want to be or not. So you do have that kind of celebration of the plebeian and the complete rejection that, well, here's you coming to sort of slum it, coming as a tourist to be with us. And he's talking about, you know, playing pools and all, getting a flat above a shop and all of this kind of thing. So yeah, there may be more of that than I'd originally picked up on. I mean, I do think the train spotting, because we haven't really talked about that. I think train spotting was really huge because, again, when you actually look into it, it felt as large and as grandiose as a Hollywood film, but it was all British, and even the references, and I mean you had the Iggy Pop, the famous Iggy Pop sort of pounding Lust for Life tune at the start, with Ewan McGregor running through the streets of Glasgow with his sort of his crop
Edinburgh hair, Princess Street,
Edinburgh, and you've knocked us off course there, Lee. But
sorry, I had to do it. I'm sorry,
but it felt like a kind of Hollywood TR movie. But all the references in it, like he talks at length about how the English are just wankers. And then there's another one of them who's like an expert on James Bond. So it feels like this is for us, and the setting, it feels like it's for us as well, but in a genuine way. Whereas now they would try to do something like that, and it would be politicized. It would be diverse. It would be then to normalize diversity or whatever the latest trend is that they want to get through. It's everything now is just pure AstroTurf, And that's why it just it's kind of hollow and flat. Whereas if you look at Trainspotting, it just feels really raw. There was even another one at the time called Brassed Off, which was a much more gentle film than Brain than Trainspotting. But that was just miners and unions in Yorkshire, and they were trying to keep the brass band going, to keep the community alive. Ewan McGregor was in that as well. So again, you got the feeling like, yeah, we have movies about us now, for a brief period of time anyway, we did.
I remember having to watch Trainspotting with subtitles on, because it really was like a completely different language to me as an American trying to watch that. So yeah, it was definitely not palatable or accommodated to American viewers.
If you think the movie's hard, try reading the book, because he spells everything phonetically, how the characters talk. So you have to kind of like translate it. It takes about 30 pages to get the hang of it. But yeah, that's part of his writing style. Now I've read all of Irvine Welsh's books up to, I think, Crime or something. It's an interesting book, and there's a lot of layers to it that aren't in the movie. Like, it's in the book, they're specifically like ethnic Irish. They're descendants of Irish Catholic immigrants, and this kind of compounds their alienation that the middle class is mostly ethnic Scottish Protestants. And the main character, Ewan McGregor's character, this really isn't featured in the book. He's like the child of a mixed marriage, but he has a Catholic mother and a Protestant father. And there's a lot of tension in the family about that. Like part of his family's disowned his family and stuff. It's very interesting. And all Irvine Welsh's books take place in a shared universe. So some of the characters from Trainspotting will make cameos in like other books of his.
Yeah, I knew people like Begbie as well. You could point out, you would have the well-meaning dopey one. What was that one called? Spud. And he had a good heart, but he was dopey. And then you had like the main character who sort of everybody identified with as Ewan McGregor. You would have the older one who was kind of the fixer who'd been around a bit. And then you'd also have the raging psychopath, which was Robert Carlyle as Begbie. And these were all working class archetypes that everybody would know. Like I knew people exactly like Begbie and the rest of them as well. So it was nice to have that.
Yeah. And as a Scottish, because I am the only Scottish person here, it was very strange to see Edinburgh on screen. And again, it was made on a tiny budget. I actually had looked at this just the other day. It actually had a smaller budget than Shallow Grave, bizarrely. I don't know how that happened, but Shallow Grave was £2.5 million and Trainspotting was £1.5 million. I really don't understand how that happened, because Trainspotting was massive compared to Shallow Grave. Shallow Grave was like a dress rehearsal. It was the same crew, the team, the writer, director, and producer, and the actor Ewan McGregor. But it was set, I think it was set in Glasgow. I can't remember, but it was definitely filmed mostly in Glasgow. And then Trainspotting was also filmed mostly in Glasgow, but the exteriors, the streets and stuff like that was all Edinburgh, because it was set in Edinburgh. So it was weird seeing that. It was really weird seeing shops that I went to, shops that I knew on Princess Street, and then down other areas nearby. Places that I'd known all my life, and suddenly they were on a cinema screen. And I actually did see it at the cinema, even though I was 12 or 13. I can't remember when it was released. We got into the cinema because the standards were very lax in those days. No one cared. So we got into the cinema, my friends and I, and it was very exciting. And this is another thing, that the soundtrack. Like, one of my friends bought the soundtrack on CD, and it was full of all these songs. Yes, Iggy Pop was American, but I think everyone else on it was British. And the soundtrack very much went with the film. It was its own... It brought a whole new facet to the film. And loads of people had that soundtrack. Like loads of people, you went into their houses, that CD would be there. It was... It's difficult to overstate this, really, how relevant Britpop was in British life at that time, in the mid and late 90s. It was, and then when it died down suddenly, there was a real sense of a come down, of disappointment and anticlimax, because there was a sense that it was going somewhere, that it was pointing to something, and then just nothing came of it, really. And then you're left with New Labour in power and darker music. No real big films. Well, Notting Hill, but that was more Americanized. You know, it had Julia Roberts in it, and it was more cutesy. It was much less aggressive and gritty and cheeky than the stuff of Britpop. It was an anticlimax.
There was a push with some of those, for I would say with This Life as well, to kind of make London look something that it wasn't. They wanted London to, you know, like how an American tourist would think of London, or how I, before I actually went there, would think of Paris, where you've got this idealized view of the place. They wanted people to have that impression of London through some of these rom-coms, which were tailored to an American audience, and it worked. And it added to that kind of positive feeling about having New Labour in power, which is why some people say Well, I mean, I don't think Trainspotting was astroturf, but especially when it comes to some of the television stuff, some of the movies, I think there was definitely a push where the Tories are gone, we've got all our friends and institutions of power now, the good times are here, you can kind of let your hair down and you can relax, London's great, we're going to bring romantic comedies back, everything's safe, and it neutered it. And what you got in its place going into the 2000s were these kind of crappy copies of, like, Coldplay would be one, and the Kaiser Chiefs. I did a video a few years ago. I did a sort of video a few years ago where I remember Jamie Oliver on his moped. You got TV programs like Jamie Oliver on his moped, and it would be like, oh no, we've got the relatives coming to come and stay. They're coming for dinner. He was a cook. He's a famous chef. But he was very young. I think he was only in his early 20s. I think he's about the same age as me. But he would be, the gist of it would be that he had like 6 hours to prepare an amazing meal. And of course, because he was this kind of hipster, he would get on his moped and drive around London, and he'd pop into all of these ethnic shops. He'd get his rice from some Vietnamese store, and he'd get coconuts from some Thai place, and then he'd pop down to a little French shop that he knew, and he'd get some wine, and he'd make little comments and pick up some snails from here and there, and he would know some...
This is tolerable.
Yeah, he would know some kind of earthy fella in a fish market where
he knows something about the guy's culture.
And so what this did, what all of this did, and he'd go back and he'd have his girlfriend there called Jules, and they'd have their flat in London, and it was all about just in time. And then at the end, you'd see there, like they'd come out of that show, This Life, it looked like they were like young business people, young go-getters from like London.
Proto-hipsterism, really.
Yeah. It sounds awful. One thing that I did when I put up the ads for this is I used a picture from Absolutely Fabulous, and I posted a note saying, this is my confession, I know nothing of the period. But... I think Absolutely Fabulous, which ran, I think, from 1992, the first four seasons were from 92 to 98, I think. I think that is an absolutely brilliant parody of neoliberalism. And it's neoliberal from the very beginning. And then, of course, by the end of the, by the fourth series, Tony Blair is actually in power, right? And it's all come to fruition. But they're portrayed, the main characters, Edina, Monsoon, and Patsy Stone, they're portrayed as incredibly materialistic, status conscious, grasping for money and status and everything, constantly signaling, and they're leftist at the same time.
And they're clinging to a youth that has long passed them by.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah. No, I really thought that was actually a quite brilliant, and objectively, it's kind of a right-wing critique of sort of neoliberal pop culture. And at the end, when New Labour's in power, it just all sort of fell together. It's like, wow, this is, they sort of saw this coming. These were the New Labourites, even before Tony Blair. But this neoliberal combination of predatory materialist hyper-capitalism and ultra-left values, including making a great fetish over non-whites. There's one thing in the fifth season, which was a really terrible season, but when Adina's daughter, Saffron, gets knocked up by a black man, she's delighted that she's going to have a mixed race baby as sort of an accessory that she can carry around to show that she's really hip and cool. I think this is around 2002 that season came out. So this is rather cutting satire.
See, that does sound far more 2000s than 90s, that storyline.
Yeah. That was 2002. But the other stuff was extremely sort of scathing at that mentality. And I can only call it neoliberal, right? It's culturally left and hyper-capitalist at the same time. It's what Jonathan Bowden was talking about when he talked about left-wing capitalism. It's all there. It's all satirized. It's quite funny.
See, another thing is, sorry, Morgoth, you go.
I was just going to say quickly on this subject is that when they actually made Trainspotting, they made Trainspotting 2, which was 20 years later. And what I did, it's going back 7 years now, but on my original blog, I did a review of it. And it was something was trying to get out there that they couldn't. And the problem they had is that if you look at the cast of characters in there, there's a lot in it when, okay, now they're middle-aged, now they're 40-ish, and they're kind of sick of the world. They're kind of everything's shit now. What happened to this? What happened to that? They don't know how to use all the smart gadgets. And because Irving Welsh is just a complete shitlib, and what I thought was interesting is that if he was going to be logical, if he was going to be true to those characters, like Renton would probably be making like right-wing videos on YouTube or writing like white nationalist blogs or doing critiques of multiculturalism and globalism. And that would be consistent with the kind of people they were. But also it would have been offering a kind of cutting commentary of the time that they're in, of what would have been 2016. But of course they can't allow that out of the bag, so they do these kind of criticisms, these mild criticisms of multiculturalism and political correctness, but they're not allowed to have any real teeth because it would run against their own, they can't really cook themselves in a way. They can't allow them that, the characters, the freedom, which is what they should have done. They should have, well, I mean, maybe the producers and, you know, you get into all the institutions and the power structure where they're kind of insecure. They're too insecure to say, yeah, you know what? It's 2016. It's after, like literally a year after the migrant crisis. There's been terrorist attacks. There's been millions of people from around the world came in since since 1996 and the original. So how would they react to all of that? And it's kind of there. They didn't turn them into shit libs. They kind of went halfway, half in, half out on it because it was something which they just couldn't allow to have a breathing space on the screen in front of a mass audience, especially when the demographic audience is going to be like white men in their 30s and 40s.
Well, this is the whole problem with gaining power. It was there with Absolutely Fabulous as well, and also with the Britpop bands, where it's easy to be the rebel and be cheeky and subversive and edgy and disillusioned, etc. But then once you gain power, first of all, a lot of things just aren't possible that you might have thought were possible. And second, your own ideas, which you do implement, backfire and turn out to be dreadful ideas. And also, you discover that the people who funded you and backed you actually never actually believed in your, never shared your beliefs, really. They were just in it for other reasons, for more ruthless reasons. So, I mean, like last year, I wrote a set of essays about a British TV show that had its heyday in the 90s called Have I Got News For You? And a big point that I had dwelt upon in that set of essays was that once New Labour came to power, see, it was a quiz show, a panel show that they would review the news each week and review the political life of Britain that week, and make jokes about the Tories, make jokes about the dull, grey, racist, bigoted, toff Tories. And they really deconstruct that, and ruthlessly, mercilessly. But then once their people got into power, New Labour, they couldn't be funny anymore, because they couldn't laugh at their own people, certainly not with the same viciousness. And they couldn't mock their own ideas being implemented, because that's their ideas, and so on. So it really left the programme quite toothless. And just irrelevant, and yet it has it's gone on and on, for it's still going now, because I think it became this flagship current affairs show, so the BBC couldn't afford to axe it, and yet it absolutely should have axed it around about 2000, because it had its day, it had its relevance, and it simply no longer had any potency. But
they were just courtiers. There weren't jesters. They're just courtiers.
Yeah. So it can't make any germane commentary anymore. And yeah. I think it's a similar thing with. I haven't seen the Trainspotting sequel. I want to do that. I want to watch that and write a comparison of the two films. But I haven't watched it yet. But it sounds like it's a similar thing where they can't critique their own ideas. But they know that they kind of have to, or they have to make.
They have to go through the motions.
Yeah, go through the motions of doing
it. It just becomes a kind of Christopher Guest kind of very, very low key humor, where they sort of titter at themselves, but they can't really criticize themselves, and so it's not funny.
Yeah, exactly. But what this leads to is tremendous amounts of hypocrisy. Mm-hmm. Again, I went into this with the Have I Got News For You essays last year, where I said they've got nothing, absolutely nothing to say about Rotherham, the Rotherham scandal. Mm-hmm. They can't afford to even refer to it. And indeed, I looked for. There was an episode of Have I Got News For You just about a month. I think the new series started a month after that report was published in August 2014. One of the biggest news stories in Britain's history, frankly, or at least it should have been. Certainly one of the biggest news stories in Britain for decades. And this current affairs program, this news program, started a month later. And didn't, as far as I can see, it didn't even mention it. Mm-hmm. Because how could they? How, you know, this is the, as I say, they'd got what they were fighting for in the 90s. They'd achieved it, and it had turned out to be absolutely hellish.
Folks, let's take a little bit of a shift now, because I'm starting to get some comments or questions in here. Let's if Morgoth or Chav, if you want to say something to what Woz just said, go ahead. And then I'd like to queue up a few questions and comments, super chats. And folks, if you'd like to add more, do the Entropy Way. You can do it through Odyssey or you can do it through DLive. So Morgoth, do you want to continue this particular topic before we shift over to some questions from the audience?
I was thinking about writing a blog on something relating to this, where I'm going to be busy this week because I've got family coming. But I think it's to go back, you know, when New Labour actually got in, the Northeast was rewarded. There was a lot of money thrown at some of these. I mean, one of the things about Labour is that in a way they do sort of take care of their friends, their client groups. And at that time, the white working class was, but until the immigration, until the backstab, of course. And you saw the Millennium Bridge got built across the Tyne, and you saw all of this. And just after the Millennium, I began to come back. I moved abroad. I worked in Holland. And when I was coming back, a friend of mine was saying, you should see what it's like down the Tyne now. There's Ethiopian restaurants, which I just thought was hilarious because I thought the whole thing about an Ethiopian is that they don't have food. But I was like, what? And it was, you should see it. There was, there's like Thai stuff down there. And he was like telling stories about, I've just met this fella from Tibet, or I've met this fella from Bangladesh, and I've been working with somebody from Algeria, and because he travelled a lot, and he thought this was like really interesting. He thought this was it was so diverse. He thought it was fascinating to meet these people from these different parts of the world. And I was reminded of this recently because now he's reached a stage where he's just terrified, where he's just absolutely mortified by the future. And in the beginning, when around about this time, a little bit later, and like it took a year or two, and then it began to change really. I mean, the whole kind of feeling changed. And in the beginning, people did think like that about the immigration. They did see them as individuals with a story to tell, and they would have their own identity. They'd have their own culture. They wanted to know what it was like where they came from, and this kind of thing. And you see that kind of trust has just been so thoroughly abused. Where now, to take him as an example, he dreads going to a hospital with his daughter because he says it's just like being in Africa. There comes a point where you just don't see them as individuals anymore. It's just this kind of biomass. It's just this endless ocean of the other. And there's no longer any kind of mystique. There's no longer any kind of curiosity about where they come from. They're just these kind of grimy people in shell suits and leather jackets, and every, there's just this exhaustion with it. And it's just funny to think, going back to the era that we're talking about towards the end of it, where there was still that sort of optimism. You know, there was still that kind of, well, you know, he's from Algeria and he's got these interesting kebabs, they taste really nice. And you, it just seems it seems tragically naive, but it's also just such an amazing breach of trust. It's really, really sickening.
Well, that is one of the things about Northern Europeans, especially. We take great pleasure in being open. It's part of the high trust society thing. We're the ones who let down our shields and take the risk of reaching out because we have this deep-seated idea that if we do this, if we're big people, if we take the risk of civility, we can create bigger and better communities. And yes, that has been thoroughly, I think, destroyed at this point. Most people are they have too much experience to go into this so naively and trustingly anymore. Of course, the you know, the establishment wants us to do that. They play on that. But people who have got experience of this are getting diversity fatigue, massive amounts of diversity fatigue. And really, it's only people like us out on the margins who are talking about this honestly. And it's only people like us on the margins who have anything really funny to say about the establishment, because the establishment itself, these people can't laugh at themselves. They're so incredibly smug, sanctimonious, and po-faced about their dogmas. I have a couple questions here.
Can I just say one last thing?
Yeah.
Because something that we should have... Well, actually, two things. The Bridget Jones's Diary. We didn't mention that. Now, I haven't seen any of those films, but I did see a clip from one of them on, I think it was on TV. And she in voiceover was talking about New Labour coming in, and she said something like, they don't mind gay people, and they want to support single mothers, this kind of thing. So that was something I should have said earlier, but it didn't occur to me. It was this idea that New Labour was the future, and it's the obvious, it's what we need, it's what we've been needing for 20 years now, while we've been stuck with the Tories. So that's one thing. And then the other thing about, to talk about Britpop as the music, is that it was the last time when, and Morgoth I'm sure will back me up on this, it was the last time when there seemed to be an era that was distinct and popular, but mostly just distinct, that you could see that was... That's before Britpop, and then this is Britpop, and then that's after Britpop. Ever since then, and I have seen it described as the music industry's last gold rush. That's partly because of things like Napster and the internet, but I think it's also partly because of the phenomenon that we've talked a lot about, which is that in the 21st century, there just hasn't been innovation. There haven't been new genres. There haven't been new aesthetics and so on. I think that Britpop, I mean, yes, it riffed on previous things, but it was a new thing. It was a new aesthetic to some extent. And it definitely did have its own life. It had its own era. And there just hasn't been anything like that ever since. I mean, 25 years of this century now, and I don't think there's anything that you could point to that is comparable to Britpop in its distinctiveness or in its scale and popularity. Nothing at all. Just maybe niche stuff on the internet. But yeah, so that's another part of it, that it was the last time that people got excited collectively about something new in music.
Well, another thing it used to be that like music scenes would often be based around like one city. Like a grunge was based in Seattle, like 80s hair metal was all in LA, thrash metal all came from San Francisco, there was the Manchester scene. Now Britpop was kind of unusual. It started as a London thing, but it eventually went nationwide. But it seems like music's not really like kind of based or geographically based anymore. I think people kind of get popular on the internet and then sort of get famous from there. So there's not really kind of the, you know, communal aspect. Because a lot of the Britpop bands like knew each other before they were famous. There was a lot of networking and cliquishness. And I think in the internet area, a lot of the geographical roots of music isn't what it was anymore.
I mean, a band that came after Britpop, which were very much in that vein, were the Arctic Monkeys. And they had a few years where they were huge, and I don't know if they're still going. I don't know what's happened with them. But they leaned into that thing as well. I think they were from Sheffield. Somebody probably correct us in the
chat. I believe in the chat. Yeah, they were the first like internet success story.
Yes. Yeah, they were picked up off YouTube, weren't they? They were posting their
MySpace.
Songs.
To YouTube. I think they were the MySpace.
MySpace. But their songs were kind of strange because it had that, like with Pulp, and to be fair, a lot of the Oasis songs are you really get the feeling that you're just finishing sort of work on at a building site somewhere, and you're on your way home, and you're popping in for a beer, and you get that. But with Oasis, with some of them, they make it seem sort of grandiose and epic, even though that, again, like with the rest of them, that they're talking about something which is mundane, and that's actually very nice and poetic. And the Arctic Monkeys kind of did that as well, but I always thought it was strange because the aesthetic and the way that they were talking, it was sort of stuffed with nostalgia. Even a nostalgia that would go back before the 90s and back into the 80s or something. And all of the look of the videos as well, it was as if they were trying to do the Britpop thing over, but then more so. So it had an even sort of harsher sense of Britishness. And the lyrics again were like this kind of, what was it? I bet you look good on the dance floor, dancing around like it's 1984. And it was about people, you know, picking up a prostitute in a grotty car. He was a pervert. And they did all of that, but it somehow felt as if they were trying to recapture something which was gone. And they'd come too late, like way too late, and they were trying to sort of bring it back in a way. And it had a kind of sadness to the whole music that they produced.